बाहुबायाम अश्विनो कुष्णो हस्ताभ्याम कृतबाहवः भावन्तु अद्वर्यवस्थान्ये वस्ताश्मश्रुर्भृगुर्भवेत्। Word to word meaning. Bahubhyam. With two arms. Ashvinaha. Of Ashwini Kumara. Kushnaha. Of Kusha. Hastabhyam. With two hands. Kritabahavaha. Those in need of arms. Bhavantu, they will have to. Advaryavaha, the priests. Cha. And Anye, others. Bastasmarshuhu, the beard of the goat. Grihu, Brigu, Bravet, he may have. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. Those who have had arms, he will have the beard from the goat's head. Purport. Brighamuni, a great supporter of Daksha, was awarded the beard of the goat's head, which was substituted for the head of Daksha. It appears from the exchange of Daksha's head that the modern scientific theory that the brain substance is the cause of all intelligent work is not valid. The brain substance of Daksha and that of a goat are different. But Daksha still acted like himself, even though his head was replaced by that of a goat. The conclusion is that it is the particular consciousness of an individual soul which acts. The brain substance is only an instrument which has nothing to do with real intelligence. The real intelligence, mind and consciousness are part of the particular individual soul. It will be found in the verses ahead that after Daksha's head was replaced by the goat's head, he was as intelligent as he had previously been. He prayed very nicely to satisfy Lord Shiva and Lord Vishnu, which is not possible for a goat to do. Therefore, it is definitely concluded that the brain substance is not the center of intelligence. It is the consciousness of a particular soul that works intelligently. The whole movement of Krishna consciousness is to purify the consciousness. It doesn't matter what kind of brain one has, because if he simply transfers his consciousness from matter to Krishna, his life becomes successful. It is confirmed by the Lord Himself in Bhagavad Gita that anyone who takes up Krishna consciousness achieves the highest perfection of life, regardless of whatever abominable condition of life he may have fallen into. Specifically, anyone in Krishna consciousness goes back to Godhead, back to home, on leaving his present material body. ओम ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूप कदा मह्यं ददाति स्वपदान्तिकं। वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरुः श्रीयुतपदकमलं श्रीगुरुन् वैष्णवांश्च श्रीरूपं साग्रजातम् सहगण रघुनाथान्वितं तं सजीवं साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजन सहितं कृष्ण चैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधा कृष्णपादान् सहगण ललिता श्रीविशाखान्वितांश्च। हे कृष्ण करुणा सिन्धो दीनबन्धो जगत्पते गोपेश गोपिकाकान्त राधाकान्त नमोस्तुते। तप्त काञ्चन गौरङ्गी राधे वृन्दावनेश्वरी ऋषभानुसुते देवी प्रणमामि हरिप्रिये। वाञ्छाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यः एव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द। Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasadi Gaurabhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So here we see how Lord Shiva, who is very expert in head transplant, he had already done that for his own son. And that's how Lord Ganesh got his elephant head. And even in that case, we see how the prowess of Lord Ganesh was not decreased. In fact, it increased after having got the head of an elephant. Here again we see Lord Shiva being satisfied with the prayers offered by Lord Brahma. If we observe the prayers of Lord Brahma, simultaneously he was offering prayers and also making a request. He was glorifying Lord Shiva in the mood of a Shaivite, considering him to be the supreme and glorifying him in that way. So whenever prayers or glorifications are offered to Lord Shiva, Prabhupada explains in 8th canto, when the demigods approach Lord Shiva and offer prayers to him for protection, there Prabhupada mentions that whenever prayers are offered to Lord Shiva or glorifications, it is to be understood that the prayers are directed towards Lord Vishnu, because Lord Shiva acts as a representative of Vishnu, and that is why prayers are getting offered to him. So there is no contradiction in that sense as to why Lord Shiva is being glorified. And in Bhagavad Gita also, Krishna, when he is describing various opulences, he describes how of all the Rudras, I am Lord Shiva. So we understand that prayers when offered to the demigods who are like most powerful in this sense, Lord Shiva is not a demigod, but he has got a category of his own, Shiva Tattva. So we understand that he is acting on behalf of the Lord. So as a part of the prayers, Brahma requested Lord Shiva to restore the bodily parts of the persons who got affected, and one of them is Bhrigu. And then Brahma also wanted that the sacrifice should resume, and ultimately, because sacrifice is for satisfying Vishnu, that shouldn't be stopped. Because as part of glorifying Brahma puts forward, because you have created this Varnashram system, you should not be the cause of destroying it. So you should revive it back again. Even sadhus are compassionate to others, and you are a most topmost of all the Vaishnavas, so you must be compassionate. And he put forward his request. So let Daksha get back his life, let Bhaga get back his eyes, let Bhrigu get his moustache back, and let Kusha get his teeth back. These are the requests. Even though Lord Shiva got pacified, he partially agreed to the requests of Lord Brahma, and that's how we see the mood. And Lord Shiva explains why he is doing so. He is not punishing out of envy, but he is there to teach a lesson. Again, we have to understand that this also is doing it on behalf of the Lord. So yesterday's verse where we saw Pusha will have to chew only through the teeth of his disciples. At the same time, Lord Shiva says that those demigods who have agreed to give my share of the sacrifice will recover all their injuries, recover from all their injuries. And today's verse talks about those who have had their arms cut off will have to work with the arms of Ashwini Kumara. Ashwini Kumara is one of the demigods. When the creation is described and where each bodily function is being taken care of by every demigod, Ashwini Kumaras take care of the nostrils. But I don't know why their arms are being used. I couldn't find any answer for that. And Lord Shiva goes on to say, those who have had their hands cut off will have to work with the hands of Pusha. Then the priest will have to work in that manner. And then finally, for Bhrigu, he'll have to get the beard of the goat's head. The same goat's head which is going to be put on Daksha's body. So that's going to be substituted for Daksha's head. So Lord Shiva's desire is that Bhrigu get the beard of a goat's head. Having seen the background leading to this event, Prabhupada, in this particular purport, in his usual style of cracking his whip against the scientists, he goes on to explain how brain is not the center of consciousness, whereas it's the soul. From there only the consciousness emanates from. We'll try to read from a few sections of Life Comes From Life, where Prabhupada talks about this particular theme. This is from the 12th morning walk, May 17, 1973. Scientific knowledge comes from Krishna. This is a conversation between Krishna Kanti and Srila Prabhupada. Krishna Kanti, the doctors marvel at the complex nature of human brain. Srila Prabhupada says, yes, but it is not the brain that works the body. It is the spirit soul. Does a computer work by itself? No, a man works it. He pushes the button, then something happens. Otherwise, what is the value of the machine? You can keep the machine for thousands of years, but it will not work until a man comes to push the button. But who is working, the machine or the man? Similarly, the human brain is also a machine, and it is working under the direction of Paramatma, an expansion of God within everyone's heart. So here Prabhupada is clearly bringing out the fallacy in the claim of the scientists who have this idea where the consciousness is emanating from the brain. And I was doing a bit of research on this. I was looking at His Grace Chaitanya Charan Prabhu's website, and based on that, a little bit more research on this. Interestingly, the scientists also have come across instances where they have had the brain scan of people who are highly intelligent. And shockingly enough, the brain substance was very, very less. And these people who have had their brain scan done, they are not like ordinary people. They have done their master's degree and they are having a normal family and they are doing well in their profession. So, another instance where children were put into the brain scan, and this is particularly when they have a disease there is a fluid, too much of fluid in the brain, and to fix that they have to take brain scans. Here is the excerpt from the article. The title of the article is your brain really necessary? So this is according to a British biochemist, Donald R. Fortsky. So he is discussing about a disease called hydrocephalus, which in simple terms is water in the brain. So some people suffer from this condition where they have to go get treated, and part of the treatment they go through a brain scan. So they have symptoms of abnormal head size or mood swings and heaviness in the head. So when the scan was done, it is found that the instead of brain being in place, it's predominantly the fluid that was present inside the skull. But still the intelligence and all that was not affected completely. So this biochemist goes on to show the scans of a normal person and that of those who are having this kind of an abnormal brain side by side. And it clearly brings out, you can see the fluid there and then the brain substance there. Interestingly, this finding was never published widely, although they made a documentary about it later. But even recently, up to probably 10 years ago, the case of the person that I mentioned, who has done his master's and his master's in mathematics and is very intelligent, when they took his brain scan, again they were surprised to see that the brain substance was really less. So this particular biochemist, he is arguing that if I publish this, then it is going to create a problem to the mainstream neuroscience. If a brain which is affected by hydrocephalus, which is fluid in the brain, can store the same amount of information as that of a person who is intelligent, then they have to come in terms of how this can happen. So according to him, brain size does not scale with the information quantity. Therefore, it would seem timely to look anew at possible ways our brains might store their information. So they have come to the conclusion that the storage is not happening within the brain. It must be somewhere else. Because according to them, if the storage is happening in the brain, these intelligent persons who are leading a normal life, having going to a job, having wife and children, they are still able to have their information kept somewhere else. So this is when their research goes further. And this is where they use some of the terms which may not be understandable to common persons, but they are indicating that the storage is happening outside the physical body. So here is where the orthodox view and this biochemist's opposing view. So the orthodox viewpoint is that information relating to any long-term memory is held within the brain in some chemical or physical form. Whereas this biochemist argues, based on his findings, in some extremely minute subatomic form as yet, which is unknown to the biochemist and psychologist, or maybe it is getting stored outside the physical body. They use the term extracorporeal, which means outside the realm of your gross body. And this is where he is relating it to the latest technology. He is considering maybe it is like a cloud storage. Where the recent technology we have, you have a person and then his memory is kept on the cloud and when needed, you can access it. Basically, they're trying to get at the point where the memory or the intelligence that the person has is not within the physical realm of the body. So according to him, the brain is a receptor or transmitter of some form of electromagnetic wave particle. He doesn't say that it is the originator of that electromagnetic. He is saying the brain is a receptor or transmitter. And then he admits, of course, when speaking of extracorporeal memory, which is memory outside the physical body, we enter into the domain of mind or spirit with corresponding metaphysical implications. So here is where the use of words, but ultimately it is leading to the point where based on the findings of children and then based on the brain scan of highly intelligent people, that this particular storage is happening not within the physical body, it is happening somewhere else outside. It could be in the mind or in the spirit. And that's why they use their fancy term extracorporeal, which means outside the gross body. So psychologists or neuroscientists do not want to publish this information widely because that's going to spoil their business. Because it's a lot of research is done under the assumption that brain is the center of the consciousness. So then the exercises or pills or medicines or all the therapies that is going to boost your brain so that you can be performing well, that's all going to go down. So this is not widely published. So then if we look at opposing arguments to this particular fact that brain is not the center of the consciousness. So, okay, in that case then if a person has damage in the brain, then why does he act abnormally? If according to the statement that brain is not the origin of consciousness, but still if a person has a head damage, he doesn't still act normally. So the explanation is given by another scientist in their own terms. He gives the example of a light passing through a prism. He says light passes through a normal prism and then it produces a variety of lights on the other side. Now he says if the prism is damaged, the output of the light that's coming is definitely going to be affected. But still the damage of the prism does not prevent the origin of the light that is entering through the prism. So his point is that even if the transmitter, which is the brain, is damaged, that does not explain the origin of consciousness. So if the brain in itself is considered as a transmitter, then any damage done to that particular hardware part, say for example, if you are considering that as a hardware, then it is obviously going to affect the output, but that does not explain the source of consciousness. And scientists went on to, or these psychologists, they went on to give the example of the hardware, software and that. So according to them, and based on that, Chaitanya Charitamrita gives this example of a person who's having a computer and a printer. So he is giving a command to print. And then the printer starts working. And he gives another scenario where someone else outside you, a different user, comes to your machine or your laptop and he issues a print command. Still the printer works. Now they have used this example against an experiment which was done by another neuroscientist. He was doing research for almost 40 years. His experiment goes like this. So he takes a subject and he asks him to move different bodily parts. So he asks the subject to raise the hand. So the subject raises the hand and he asks, "What happened?" So the subject says, "I raised my hand." So the neuroscientist knows that which parts of the brain affect the movement of the arm. So he externally manipulates that part of the brain which makes the hand to move. So in the second instance, the neuroscientist manipulated some parts of the brain to make the hand of the subject go up. This time he asked the subject, "What happened?" Subject said, "I don't know, my arm went up." "Did you raise your arm?" "No, I didn't. Looks like you did it." So again the neuroscientist went back and manipulated the same part of the brain to get the arm down. Then the subject was asked, "What happened?" "I don't know, the arm fell down." "Did you do it?" "No, I didn't. Looks like you are doing something." Now this is the same principle that said about a person giving a print command in the first instance. In the first instance, when the subject is moving the hand himself, it's like a person using his own computer and a printer and giving a print command. In the second instance, it's like another person coming in and using your laptop and giving the same print command. So this neuroscientist could not come to the point of understanding in the first instance, when the person himself is raising the hand, who is giving that input to the brain so that it can function or it can manipulate it. In the second instance, he was able to manipulate the brain through external electrical signals. But in the first instance, when the person himself raised the hand, who is the one who is making the brain give that particular signal to the hand to raise? And that's where again this same neuroscientist comes to the conclusion after 40 years of such research that this cannot be within the realm of the physical body. So his conclusion points to the same thing as what the previous biochemist pointed out. It is something which is beyond the body, and that particular power is coming from beyond the body, and that's what is pushing it to move. For us, luckily, by the grace of Srila Prabhupada, he has given things in a simple terms. The consciousness comes from the spirit soul, and it is that consciousness which is actually moving or making this inanimate body animate and move and produce different activities. It is all very simple and given to us in a straightforward way, which the scientists have been doing research for many years, and they are coming to the conclusion, and they are using words like extracorporeal, behind the realm of body, in the region of mind or spirit. Even still they are not able to pinpoint to their particular location, whereas it's clear in the Shastras say consciousness comes from the spirit soul, and that's what animates the entire body. Now that we have come to the conclusion that it is the consciousness that's driving the inanimate material body. Let's look at the explanation given in Bhagavatam about how this consciousness acts in different levels. There are different levels in which the consciousness works. And the Supreme Creator, who has this master brain behind all this creation, he explains how consciousness works in different levels. So, again going back to the example of light passing through a prism and then coming out. In this instance, Vedic explanation first gives the background about the three different modes of material nature, mode of goodness, passion and ignorance. And this is going to affect your consciousness. And accordingly, the consciousness will be directed towards mind and then towards the gross body, and then through that agency it gets extended to the outside world. So to understand it in simple terms, you are sitting here and you are speaking, and then your voice goes up to this particular room, and then if you amplify the sound system, the voice may go to the next room, and then if I amplify further, it may go to the fourth room. So we being spirit soul, our consciousness, if it is in a dreamless state of deep sleep, it doesn't go anywhere. It is as if I am not speaking anything and nobody is hearing anything. So that's one explanation where consciousness is not fully pervading and it is present within the spirit soul. This happens when a person is in deep sleep. The next is the consciousness going up to the level of mind, but the body is not physically active. This is what is called as active dream state, where you are physically restricted but still the mind is active and consciousness, and that's where we get dreams, where things that we wanted to do when we are active and those unfulfilled desires, all that come about and we see different things. We do many things, but physically you are still lying in the bed and you are sleeping. And Prabhupada gives the example of a person seeing a golden mountain. He might have seen gold and he might have seen a mountain, and the dream, these two combine together, and then he sees a golden mountain. So this is a state of the consciousness where it is going up to the realm of mind. Then when a person is physically active, which means the consciousness goes beyond the mind and then it goes up to the gross body, where he is starting to become active. So in the 11th canto, when Krishna is speaking to Uddhava, he brings about all these different categories, and also he tells an alternative as where the consciousness should actually be directed. It should be directed towards a state where you are able to go beyond the three modes. And that's where the purification happens. And that's the point Prabhupada mentions in the purport about the whole purpose of Krishna consciousness is to purify one's existence. So let's look at the words of Lord Krishna, how he explains that. And this is a good way to analyze ourselves, what mode is acting on ourselves and why we act in a particular way. This is 11:25-12. The three modes of material nature, goodness, passion and ignorance, influence a living entity but not me. Manifesting within his mind, they induce the living entity to become attached to material bodies and other created objects. In this way, the living entity is bound up. So as I was mentioning, When the consciousness is directed towards the external world, then we start to scan things that we like, we dislike, and then we start to make plans of how I can enjoy them. Which means the consciousness is fully directed outside and there is no spiritual inquiry or anything happening. So then Krishna goes on to explain, this is how you create your another material body and you are getting attached to those particular bodies that you are creating, and this is called as the karana deha, which means that's causing another body for you, causal body, where all the seeds of the desires are being sown. Just as we know there is a gross body, there is a subtle body and the spirit soul, then we also have the causal body in which the plans that you make to execute those desires, all that is stored. Then Krishna goes on to explain the different modes. And this is where we can analyze ourselves. Krishna says, when the mode of goodness, which is luminous, pure and auspicious, predominates over passion and ignorance, a man becomes endowed with happiness, virtue, knowledge and other good qualities. So first is the mode of goodness. If the consciousness is passing through the mode of goodness, say the light passing through a prism, so if it is going through the channel of mode of goodness, this is the result that you get: happiness, virtue, knowledge. Now what happens if the consciousness goes through passion? What's going to happen to me? Krishna explains, when the mode of passion, which causes attachment, separatism and activity, conquers ignorance and goodness, a man begins to work hard to acquire prestige and fortune. Thus, in the mode of passion, he experiences anxiety and struggle. So, as I mentioned, what we are going through can be categorized into these sections. And accordingly, we can see which mode is acting upon us and where we should shift to. Then in the 15th verse of this chapter, Krishna explains, when the mode of ignorance conquers passion and goodness, it covers one's consciousness and makes one foolish and dull. Falling into lamentation and illusion, a person in the mode of ignorance sleeps excessively, indulges in false hopes, and displays violence towards others. This is explained in the Bhagavad Gita as well, when three modes of nature is described and how there's a constant struggle between the modes and every time one particular mode takes over. The beauty of bhakti scriptures is that they not only tell you the problem areas, they also give a wonderful solution as to how to come out of this. And Krishna explains in the 16th verse, when consciousness becomes clear and the senses are detached from matter, one experiences fearlessness within the material body and detachment from the material mind. You should understand this situation to be predominance of the mode of goodness in which one has the opportunity to realize me. Now, having looked at these modes, coming to the characters that we are dealing with in this particular episode, it's not a rocket science to figure out who is in which mode. Lord Shiva himself explained what state of consciousness he was in when he did not stand up when Daksha came into the arena. He was in the Suddha Sattva, like Vasudeva Sattvam Visitvam, Vasudeva Shabditam. So he was in that particular consciousness. And based on the symptoms of passion, the person who is attached to, in the mode of passion, what does he do? He develops excessive attachment, and he goes on to do separatism and activity, and he experiences anxiety and struggle. And Daksha Prajapati, playing the role of a person in the mode of passion and ignorance, displays this particular symptoms where he is separating, he is having a separatist vision and he is not able to see the exalted position of Lord Shiva. In the arena when Brahma was there and Lord Shiva was present and Daksha enters the arena, everyone else got up and he was expecting that Lord Shiva will also get up. Only if he had taken some moments to analyze why Lord Shiva is behaving in a particular way, and if he is not able to understand it, if he is humble enough, he could have asked Lord Brahma, who is nearby, why he is acting in this particular way. Then Brahma, who gave this entire explanation as to the position of Lord Shiva, how powerful he is, what is he doing, he would have given the same thing to Daksha, and he would have immediately come back to his senses and understood, okay, this is why Lord Shiva is acting in a particular way. So, if we are in a situation where we are not able to understand the activities of other Vaishnavas and we get agitated about it, instead of reacting and facing the consequence, which is up to the point of losing your head, we can approach another senior Vaishnava and reveal our mind and find out why is he acting in a particular way. We may not be able to comprehend within our own little brain substance that we have. And it is said, Vaishnavera Kriya Mudra Vijnana Bhuja. Even exalted personalities or logicians and others cannot understand the activities of a Vaishnava sometimes. So, this helps us to discriminate and use our intelligence. Shastras give detail, Bhagavatam especially gives detailed explanation of what mind is made up of and what intelligence is made up of. The teachings of Lord Kapila, he clearly says, doubt, misapprehension, correct apprehension, then memory, sleep, these are all part of intelligence. And it clearly gives the explanation as to where the memory is. It's not within your gross body, but it's in the subtle body, which is the intelligence aspect, and that's where memory is. As I was mentioning earlier, based on the point which Prabhupada made in this particular purport about purifying one's consciousness, the process of bhakti yoga in itself is directed towards making you detach yourself from the material sense objects, so that the consciousness which is getting directed towards the external world can be taken back and can be directed upwards. There's another state which is called Turiya, which is the highest state where your consciousness is completely directed to the Supreme Person. Because the acharyas know that a person cannot directly go to the particular level, they have given us Vairi Sadhana Bhakti, where you start following certain rules and regulations, where there are certain do's and don'ts. If you analyze from the point of view of how things work in the brain or even psychology, you have the aspect of you think, and then you feel, and then you actually end up doing the activities. So, bhakti yoga being a comprehensive process helps in purifying at all levels, whereby a person is asked to strengthen his intelligence by reading shastras, is asked to do service, which means you are engaging your intelligence along with the body and the mind in the Lord's service. So, that consciousness which is not active and which is in a state of deep sleep, and which is misunderstood by the Mayavadis to be the highest form of bliss. That consciousness is now getting directed towards activities in Bhakti Yoga. So what's happening there is the senses are getting purified, and there is enough scope for you to gratify the senses also in a proper way. We're not here to deny the needs of the senses. We're not asked to starve 365 days a year. Some days we obviously have fasting days, and other days we are asked to take the remnants of the Lord. Sevan mukehi jivado. So even if you are attached too much to food, which is the lowest level of consciousness, annamaya, Bhakti Yoga, you can still practice Bhakti Yoga. Take the Charanamrita of the Lord, and especially my Melbourne Mahaprabhu Mandir, we have tasted Charanamrita. So the point I'm making is, so even in the person in the lowest level of consciousness, who is just thinking about food, he can also start practicing Bhakti Yoga. And then if you are more into philosophical understanding, there are enough books to read, starting from Science of Self-Realization, Bhagavad Gita. And this is where you get understanding of how things work. And then if a person doesn't want to get into too much of reading, and there are a lot of things to be done, a lot of activities to be done, like cleaning the temple, decorating, so many things, where your ability to think and work, all the senses, working senses, all that are put into work for the purpose of satisfying the Lord. In that way, the persons in different levels of consciousness, everyone can find their room in Bhakti Yoga process and thereby purify themselves. And when we are convinced about the fact that we are getting purified through the process of Bhakti Yoga, then that increases our faith. Then when we are talking to people who are from a different background, from scientific background in this case, we can explain to them how things work in the platform of gross body, subtle body, and then how your consciousness is getting redirected at different levels. And any intelligent person, they will understand how things work in the process of Bhakti Yoga and how you're getting purified out of it. Another recent publication which I was going through is this book, You Are Not Your Brain. Another female author, I forgot her name, she has come up with this book, How, so You Are Not Your Brain, how you can use your mind to heal yourself, your brain, and other parts of the body. So the title itself says, which we have heard many times, you're not the body, and she's saying, you're not your brain, and how you can heal yourself. In that particular book, she has talked about the effect of meditation on different parts of the brain. So there she is mentioning how different sections of the brain affect different emotions. And one particular section of the brain is centered about yourself. Anything that happens to me, any experience that I go through, anyone tells something favorable to me or against me, all that is getting stored there. And the other part of the brain is to deal with emotions. And I'm not giving the technical details. So few other sections of the brain deal with memory, then intelligence, all that. According to her, if a person does meditation, it has got a very significant positive impact on all the sides of the brain, where a person can become more alert and active. And she makes this interesting point. You become less self-centered. that part of the brain which talks about me-centeredness gets pacified or gets an effect where it's no longer thinking in terms of self-centeredness. And that portion of the brain which deals with others' emotions, that is becoming more prominent, and you are able to understand the feelings of others, how others think and feel, and you are able to relate to people who were normally hard to deal with before you started meditation. So she gives this wonderful analysis as to how the effect of meditation has a profound positive impact on all the sections of the brain. The reason I'm mentioning this, if you're talking to people from that particular background, we can explain things to them in this way and then explain the process of mantra meditation as to how the sound vibration is so powerful that it can go through all the levels of coverings and it can actually enrich the spirit soul. And from there the consciousness, when it emanates and goes through different layers, as I mentioned, then accordingly you have the control where your consciousness is getting adapted to, rather than the senses pulling you in different directions. And this is how we can analyze ourselves when we are in different situations and pull the strings wherever needed to pull us back, and also help others. If others are in difficult situations, we can also help them, we can relate to them, and thereby we can work together in the Bhakti Yoga process and purify ourselves and purify and help others. I'll stop here. Let's see if there are any questions. So the question is how the spirit and the action are connected. Prabhupada explains consciousness is the symptom of the soul. So the fact that I exist means I am conscious. So to understand this, fire cannot be separated from heat and light. Fire emits heat and light. So spirit soul, if you are alive, then you are conscious. So spirit soul is always conscious. So it is inherent in the spirit soul to be consciousness. There is no part where it is, okay, this is spirit soul, this is consciousness, and then now you are trying to link with it. So by the understanding of fire, heat and light, can you separate heat and light from fire? No, it is part of the fire. It's the nature of the water to flow, nature of the salt to be salty. So, you understand by that, the symptom of the soul is consciousness. So then, the next question about how does the spirit soul act? So as I was explaining So, when the consciousness is directed towards external sense objects, then you start to develop a desire to enjoy, acquire, all that. So, at that point, the consciousness is acting at the level of liking, disliking. I want this, I don't want this. So, Vedic psychology explains, which means you're thinking in terms of likes and dislikes, so you are in the platform of mind. The moment you start making plans as to how I will get the object and enjoy. Then you are starting to think how to get the object. So then you are starting to think in the level of intelligence. You have to make plans. Say for example, you have to go to the city, you have to eat a nice food and the restaurant is in the city. So then you have decided, okay, now I want the food and I have to eat it. So then go to the tram, go to your mobile phone, go to the tram checker, check the time when the tram is coming, go, get back and then get to the destination, use Google Maps, go to the restaurant. Yeah, so that point of time you are acting in the level of intelligence, how to get the desired object. And then you start to experience, as you said, okay, then when you put the food in your mouth, that's when you're starting to actually experience. So that desire which started, okay, I must have a nice food, so that originated and then you started to like it, okay, then you started to make plans, then we are actually going and actually experiencing it. So the taste, all that comes through the sense object, and it is the, because the soul is present, that's why enjoyment is there. Even if you feed a nice food to a dead body, there's no way a dead body can taste anything. So the presence of the soul is what makes the person relish. So this is how the consciousness in itself is a symptom of the soul. Then once you start making plans and all that, as I said, intelligence, then emotions only, then at the level of the mind, and only directed towards where my food is, where defending, all that level, basic animalistic needs. So then you're at the lowest level, the consciousness hasn't developed. And that's where you see different types of bodies also. I'm not sure if other philosophies explain why there are different types of bodies, why there is a plant body, why there is a bird body, why there is, yeah. And Prabhupada's purports explain, a person who wanted to remain naked, he has got the body of a tree. So like that, if you, depending on the consciousness, you get the body. Does that make sense? Yes,
Prabhu. You mentioned the symptoms of the modesty nature.
Yes, Prabhu.
In the 11th canto. Yeah. And one of the symptoms of the word passion is attachment and differentiation.
Yes.
And activity.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that the impetus for activity is obvious.
Yes.
For attachment. And in the mode of goodness, what is the impetus then for action? There's no attachment, or they're not distinguishing between the likeness or not likeness. So what is the impetus for action?
In the mode of goodness. Yeah, the question is, in the mode of passion, the word activity is being mentioned, and also attachment. Now, what is the impetus for action in the for a person in the mode of goodness? In the mode of goodness, the Krishna explains that there is a good opportunity to realize Him. So, even there, your activity is still going to be there, but the motivation for the activity is to please the Lord. Or in the very first instance, the motivation for activity is for self-realization rather than gratifying my senses. The activities are going to be redirected towards self-realization, and then next step of connection between me and the Supreme Self, then. So activities are also going to be there, but they are guided by a pure purified motive. Whereas in the passion, as you mentioned, your motive is to enjoy a particular object based on your own attachment. And if somebody else hinders that particular enjoyment, then the other lower emotions like anger and all that come up. Whereas a person in the mode of goodness is redirecting his activities with a proper motive for self-realization and for satisfying Krishna, even when his attempts are, even if he is facing failure in his attempts, he is still equipoised. So the impetus for action in the mode of goodness comes from the motive to realize oneself and also to serve the Supreme. That's what I feel, yeah, based on my limited understanding. But interestingly enough, that I had the opportunity to read Shrihotra Swami's book, Vedanta Psychology. So there Maharaj explains in detail about attachment. So the way he explains is, to control desires, you have to control you have to watch your, where you're getting attached to. And attachment is what is driving your activities. So if you want to redirect your activities, so then you'll have to shift your attachment from material to spiritual. And that's, in one way, it will answer your question, like, in the mode of goodness, the impetus for action is to redirect our attraction from matter to spirit. So, hopefully, is that okay? Anyone wants to add to that? Probably end here. Grantra Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Samaved Bhaktavinda ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.